The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, number 151, for Monday, May 5th, 2008.
And welcome to the Cinco de Mayo version of the Mac Geek Gab.
We begin.
This might be our first Cinco de Mayo, John. I have not checked. I didn't really think about it until just now, but it's possible. It's our first
no
Cinco
hablo
de Mayo.
No hablo español.
Okay. All right. Well, welcome everyone. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for tuning in. If we can use that vernacular. We have, we're still digging through this backlog of questions. I don't know what we're going to have to do. I know we've been toying about with this whole idea of a second show a week or something, John, but the question volume certainly speaks to the demand for that, and that's all I'm going to say about it. We've got startup sounds to talk about, file types, EQ, time capsule, and we're even going to talk a little bit about bits and bytes, I think. Should we?
We're going to get. But, so this weekend, this is something I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. Maybe my worst enemy. But I told you what I was doing this weekend. So it has nothing to do with Mac, but it kind of does, because, I've never had a machine get to the point where I had to totally wipe everything out. But my work laptop with XP, it got to the point where I think it was VMware. I tried to install it. The installer said everything was great. Or no, it didn't. It got to a point in that it hung there forever. So the installer mechanism was damaged.
Not good. Trying
to repair, install, and then it wouldn't apply system updates. There's a way you can replace the core OS components. So it was hosed.
Huh.
So now I'm, slowly going through the process of, so I reformatted, not with the Dell copy, which includes all sorts of weird stuff in there, but with a, fresh version of XP, SP2. Got the drivers from Dell, and so hopefully it'll remain stable for a while. But it's it's always kind of terrifying, which is why we're going to talk about time capsule. But that's why having something like that is great comfort, because I'm like, man, did I forget something? Did I not transfer some data over and stuff like that? And I still don't think Windows is at the point where it can bring a kind of working system over. Pull all your stuff over. In this case, that there really wasn't an option to do that. So.
All right.
Sorry to burden you with that, but
Made
me all appreciate the Mac all the more, where, much all the drivers and all the goodies you need are all included, and you're just, up and running.
And the chances that you need to do I certainly don't set myself up as an Apple apologist. There are things about the Mac that are not perfect, but in this scenario where you're considering or being forced essentially to totally wipe your machine and bring it back, with a Windows machine, that's a pretty regular occurrence from my experience. Of course, my experience is mostly on the consulting side. So I would see machines with problems instead of the machines that were working well. So my views are tainted, but yeah, certainly far more regular occurrence with the problematic machines on the Windows side as opposed to the problematic machines on the Mac side. But there is something we were talking about last week with Windows, John, versus the Mac, where Windows did it better because you could set a startup sound. Well, we got an email from Ikuma, and I think I'm pronouncing that right, who found something called System Sound Extension. Now, it's not really an extension because it's a Mac OS X thing, and I'm pretty sure it's not an extension. I think it's just a preference pane.
Yes.
But it's a preference pane that lets you set up startup sounds, shutdown sounds, et cetera, et cetera. And we'll post a link to the page where you can go and download this. So if you want to create a startup sound with Mac OS X, that's really the easiest way to do it. There's ways to open files and this, that, and the other, but this way actually plays the startup sound without launching separate apps and doing all sorts of different things. So
now you didn't want to talk about opening files, say with the open command.
I sure didn't. And we're going to go right on to Todd, with file associations and types to kind of continue that conversation for us.
Yeah, this is ADD Todd out of Orem, Utah, and I'm calling in response to Mac Geek Gab 150. File information. Both Mac and PC, I know through personal experience, having crapped my systems quite often, also put as a header in the file in the first, 10, 15, maybe 20 bytes, exactly what type of file it is. Some of the file recovery utilities that I've found make a stab at it when you're recovering files, and they'll go ahead and put on the extension that they think it is. But I have learned to use a text editor that does, you know, programming extensions, so on and so forth, drag it into there to open and look at the file, and the first line always says what it is, whether it's a JPEG, a text file, or whatever. PC OS half the time only looks at that when you double-click it and doesn't tell you what it's finding. Mac OS, on the other hand, when there's no extension, will look at that and say, oh, this is a JPEG, or oh, this is a text file, and it will open the associated program or application that would read it. I won't give you my email, and I won't give you my phone number, because I really don't expect you to call back. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, Todd. Yeah, so what this points to is we were talking about how there were files without the extension, and how does this, how do it know, right? That was kind of the discussion we were having last week.
Do it know? You know what I think it is?
What's that?
I think it's magic.
It, you know what, John? It is magic. And Hank wrote in and actually explained this. Apparently, you know, I've been using Unix for a long time, arguably the first OS I ever learned. And I never heard about this, but it predates my time with Unix, so obviously it's always been there. There's a command called file, and what it does is it compares a file against whatever file you pointed at. So, you know, if you've got a file called test picture, you say file space text test picture, and this is from the command line, and it compares that file against a database of sorts, which is stored in /usr/share/file/magic, as it were, John. And what this magic file has in it is it says, okay, you know, it's got, I think, four fields for each line. And the first field says offset. So how far from the beginning of the file are we going to look for some identifying character? So you set the offset. You set what it is. So, you know, in the case of a JPEG, it's going to be a string. And then you set what in fact it's looking for. And you know, that might be the characters JPEG. And then if all those match, what the file is. And then you set, you know, MIME type or something like that. So that's what this does. And actually, it goes pretty far. If you pointed at a PNG file, let's see, I'm looking for Tony's email here, which I didn't grab it. But it actually goes ahead and shows you, the bit depth of the file and some various other attributes. So it's a pretty in-depth command. And clearly the OS takes advantage of this when it's trying to figure out what a file is, and why shouldn't it, right? The service is there. That's the beauty of building an operating system or building an interface on top of a robust operating system like Unix is you can tap into all this stuff, and clearly they have. So yeah, very, very, very cool. And thank you, Todd and Hank and Tony and Harold and everybody who wrote in and mm-hmm. told us all about this. So,
and if you want to get down and dirty, the actual file itself, which you and I looked at it, it's pretty sizable. It's in, I believe, /usr/share/file, and it's called
Magic.
And yeah, you can, you know, load it in an editor, do a more grep through it to look for things. But yeah, what did you find? It's about 12,000 lines, I think.
Yeah. I did a word count. Again, another terminal command, WC from the terminal, and then a file name will tell you some details about the file. And the first, I typically only use the first two results that I get. And those are the number of lines and then the number of words. So, but yeah, it was a little over 12,000 lines in, at least in the version in Leopard. So,
yeah. And I've tried the old text editor trick. I mean, sometimes it doesn't work, because if the data is, binary,
yeah,
and that it's not meant to be human readable, then sometimes the editor may show some weird stuff, but you're hoping that the very beginning of the file, which, you know, I've done it on like JPEGs and stuff,
yeah,
like that, but almost always you're going to get something that kind of gives you a little hint. And I guess this, file in Magic just, it does a very comprehensive job of that. So
it does. It
very
does.
Good tip.
All right. And one more thing from Cirrus. He writes, I don't recall you mentioning this on the show, but in Leopard, at least, you can control click on a file or right click if you have a mouse that supports that. and then hold down the Option key. And that actually changes the context menu option from open with to always open with. And that way, back to our discussion last week, let's say you have PDF files and you install Acrobat and now they're always set to open with Acrobat. If you want to change that for all PDF files, you right click on one, hold down the Option key, and then select always open with, say, preview, and then it'll set it back. Of course, you can do this from the get info window, just like we discussed last week, but you know, the Option key to the rescue. So a fantastic little shortcut there for us, John. I like it. I like the Option key stuff. Very cool. All right. Our first sponsor for this show is Smile on My Mac. And tonight we're talking about Text Expander. I am a very, very happy user of Text Expander. And there was one thing about it that drove me crazy. I type very fast. I've been clocked at, you know, 120 plus. And Text Expander with Leopard was giving me some problems where I would type some characters and then it would retype them again. And Smile on My Mac heard about this from various users and rushed to a fix. And the new version of Text Expander that just came out last week, I believe it's 2.3.1, but just go to the smileonmymac.com/textexpander, I believe, or just go smileonmymac.com. That'll certainly get you. But I think /textexpander will get you right to where you're going to be able to download this. Now, what does it do? Text Expander is a shortcut application. So let's say I have some bit of text that I type over and over again, like my name. Well, at the end of emails, anybody that's gotten an email from me sees that I type my name -D, -Dave. And so I type -D and bam, it types -Dave for me. But you can use it for much longer strings of text. Like when I'm building the show notes, there's some things that are automated in there or some things that are repeated in there. So I have, you know, 7 or 8 lines worth of stuff and I hit, you know, comma MGGT because that's the shortcut I've set up for the Mac Geek Gab teaser and bam, right through, no problem. And it just puts all that stuff right out there in whatever application I happen to be in. You can, of course, set it to be app specific. And that's the beauty of Text Expander. It lives as a little preference pane. It's $29.95, available from smileonmymac.com. And of course, you can download a free demo and check it out. So you want to talk about bits and bytes, John?
Oh, you betcha.
All right. Well, Aaron asks, over the last few weeks, you've talked about various download / upload speeds. And I've got to say, I'm totally lost on what is considered fast. I could also use some clarification on the differences between kilobytes and kilobits when referring to downloads and uploads. Which is faster? Okay, you go ahead, John. You got this one.
Yeah, because we should start here. So I want to give we want to get a baseline here, and the place to start, though things get kind of funny, but computer people, the most basic piece of data in your computer is something called a bit, which I think stands for, I don't think it's an urban legend, but it stands for binary digit. It can be a 1 or a 0. And this is in a numbering system. It's different from the way that you and I count in that it's what we're going to call base 2, and that there are 2 possible values, 0 or 1. The number system that you and I use for the most part, Dave, is base 10, where there are 10 different digits. And you can even get into different things like something called hexadecimal, which is 16 digits. Well, there's only 10, so they use letters. But you get the idea. And as you start growing, and the first difference here is that you have a bit and a byte. A byte is always 8 bits. Remember that. So if you're given a speed in kilobits, and the typical way that's represented, I don't know if there's a standard for the first. I tend to prefer a capital K, Dave, for kilo.
Yeah, but I don't think it matters. K. Yeah.
I don't think that matters, but the character that comes next does matter.
Oh, yeah.
And if it's a small b, you're talking kilobits. If it's a big B, you're talking kilobytes. And as we just mentioned, a byte is bigger than a bit, so kilobytes are faster. Now, here's a problem. So that answers that. And then he has a question here, you know, what is this speed? And you could normalize things. And so he has a speed here, 9610 kilobits per second. Now, one way to convert it is, and I love this for various reasons. We may deviate or come back to this here. But a good way to convert these units, well, you know, let me step back a bit here. So this is where things get a bit complicated.
Yeah.
because things start to become different when you're talking K, which most people acknowledge means 1,000, right? So if you say, I want 1K of something, most people would interpret that, unless you're a computer person, would interpret that to mean you want 1,000 of something.
Right. If somebody writes $10K, I know that we're talking about $10,000 even.
That is correct. So, now, for whatever reason, computer people had to do it different.
But there is a reason, but we'll talk about it. But you already said it. It's because we're talking about powers of 2 as opposed to powers of 10. But right. Go ahead. So because of that, computer people call K
2 to the 10th or 1,024. So there's a little difference. It's 1,024 instead of 1,000. Well, as you start getting to greater powers or greater numbers, you start deviating more and more wildly. So if you're talking, for example, a megabyte, rather than being a million, it's 1,048,576, which is also 2 to the 20th. And to step back a bit, 1K is 2 to the 10th. So I think I'm making this clear. The yep. The point that I really want to make is that when you're talking representations on the computer, the K is different from a normal K or a meg or a gig. And it just gets worse and worse as you start moving along. So now a conversion tool. So first I want to cover a conversion tool, and then I want to wag my finger at Apple and the hard drive industry, I think, in general.
Okay. I'm glad we have an agenda here.
Well, you know, let me wag my... let's go for Apple here. So,
No. Stick with the agenda. Talk about the conversion tool. Always good to stick with the agenda.
Okay. All right. So conversion tool. Now, you know, a lot of times it's just really hard to keep track of what units... Converting between different units, it's hard. But, you know, the swell guys over at Google, they made it really, really easy. So if you want to convert from one unit to another, and you can just put this in a regular Google search. But say you want to know, for example... You know, 1 kilobyte equals space equals question mark kilobits. Oh, well, 1 kilobyte is a kilobit. That's just a trivial example. But you can do all sorts of byte and bit and other conversions with the Google calculator. And it gets kind of crazy. It just doesn't do things like this. So it can do megabits and kilobits. And you can convert between different units. And it just does a really good job. But you're not only it not only does that. And then I started sending kind of funny examples to you, Dave. Like, for example, you can convert from the ever popular unit of furlongs per fortnight and find out how many miles per hour that is.
Because, yes. You know, I like
so
it.
The calculator gets kind of silly because I don't think anybody really uses furlongs per fortnight as a measure they use day to day, though I could be wrong.
Well, I mean, you know,
I think it's naval based. I guess a furlong is a measure when you're on a boat, right? Isn't it a furlong or what's a? I don't know.
yeah, it's like just a little over a meter, right? Kilometer. It's a little over a kilometer. We'll look it up. Yeah, 1,000 almost 1,006 meters. Is what a furlong is. And
okay, but the Google calculator will tell you that, but it'll also tell you some other interesting things, like especially in light of my recent birthday, one question you could ask it is, what is the answer to life, what you want to say is the answer to life, the universe, and everything equals question mark. And of course, everybody knows that the answer to life, the universe, and everything is
42.
And the Google calculator knows that.
That's good. All right.
But another thing it does, which I think is built into the calculator, and you mentioned this, Dave, was currency conversion. Mm-hmm. And actually, I was doing this when I was out in France. So you could say, you know, you got to be careful with the way you word it, but you could say, you know, $1 equals question euros, and it'll tell you how many euros is with the current rate. But Google calculator is amazing how it just knows all this stuff here. So that's a handy tip for everybody, whether you're calculating, network throughputs or whatever. But now here's my finger wag. Okay, now you remember, you do remember where I told you what a gigabyte is, Dave, right?
Yeah, you did. You told me a gigabyte is based on that whole base 2 thing where we're talking about powers of 2, correct?
Yeah. So for example, a gigabyte, according to the definition, is 2 to the 30th, which is... 1,073,741,824. I think that's right. Yeah. Now, Here's a problem that I have, though, with I don't think it's just Apple. I think it's the hard drive industry. But riddle me this. So I'm looking at the description for one of their latest machines, and it describes the hard drive space, and then it has a little footnote. And what it says is, by the way, for hard drive capacity measurements, 1 GB, which I'm assuming that means a gigabyte, equals 1 billion bytes.
Right.
Do you see the problem here?
Yeah. Well, it's actually it's become accepted that gigabyte has two definitions. One is the base 10 version, and the other is the base 2 version. And
it, well, I know I don't accept that. A gigabyte is a gigabyte. It's defined. It's 2^30 power. That is a gigabyte.
Or
Apple can't change the definition of
or it's 10^9 power. It is both, depending on context. Talking about RAM, it's 2^30. Talking about anything else, typically, it's 10^9. We're still talking about bytes versus bits.
I say that anything that involves the storage of bytes should go by the computer system.
I'll actually agree with you there. Yeah.
Yeah. No, you got to be consistent because then I ran this utility and then I got a little upset because I ran this utility and on my portable, I remember when I purchased the machine, I got it with the 250 gigabyte drive, as I think you did, right?
Right. Right. That's correct.
And I ran this utility and it says total capacity, 232.9 gigabytes, parentheses, 250.059.350.016 bytes.
Right.
If I remember, I purchased a 250 gigabyte drive, not a 232.
Now that's actually interesting because you're talking about the same thing two different ways. If the operating system is going to call the drive by 2^30 as a gigabyte, well, then that's how you should sell it, or you should change the OS. But the OS is always going to be base 2.
The thing is, Disk Utility is reporting it properly in that it, as far as I can see, is reporting the proper gigabyte capacity, which is based on the binary system.
Yeah.
But in parentheses, they put the 250. So I don't think Apple is alone in this. I think it's generally the hard drive industry, as you said, Dave. Uh-huh. They wanted to latch on. Because the thing is, a gigabyte is more than the conventional. So if they can make it smaller, they can give you relatively less and still say, this is a 250 gigabyte drive. So
that's right.
That's a wag of my finger, not only to Apple, but to the entire hard drive industry. Shame on you for stealing all those bytes away from people.
So I think we've exhausted that. Yeah. The one thing I will add, since Aaron had asked about internet speeds, he's going to speedtest.net. He's doing a download test and he's getting 9610 kilobits per second. Now, a lot of times things like menu meters or things like that are actually going to report in kilobytes or sometimes even megabytes or megabits. So menu meters would actually report that as not 9610 kilobits, but 1201 kilobytes, or and I'm doing my math very quickly here, but
Google calculator.
What's that? Google calculator. Right. That's right. And we got to do per second. That's right. That would be 1.17 megabits per second, and that's what you're going to see on your download meter in Google. Megabytes per second. MB, capital B is bytes. Mm-hmm. Lowercase b is bits. Correct, John?
Yes. So, okay. So I would say, in general, that's what I've seen for a decent cable modem connection.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
A megabyte a second. I think here, Optimum Online, even though they're... the cable TV branch is starting to annoy me because they're taking my channels away. I got to say the download speed is one of the best I've seen, and I've seen sustained of about 1.5 megabytes.
Yeah, download. That's great.
Now, I don't know if that's good for Japan, though, because from what I understand in, Japan, Korea, and a lot of those countries, they blow away. I mean, you just look at the gadgets that they get way ahead of us as far as phones and stuff like that. And I was under the impression that they have the potential. So maybe it's just the class of service they can't afford, but I think they have the potential for much faster speeds.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's move on to Pat. Pat has an interesting question here.
Hey, John and Dave. This is Pat up in Minnesota. I had a question about system equalizers or something like that. I'm looking for a little program that could help me out with an equalizer for my entire computer, not just iTunes. Hopefully you could help me out with that. This is where you'd want to cut me off.
Okay, then we will cut you off. Okay, yeah, so, you know, we've all used the iTunes equalizer where, or maybe we haven't, but if you go into iTunes and you go to the advanced menu, right? No, the window menu, you can choose equalizer. And you'll see a window that looks a lot like the old graphic EQs that we or perhaps our parents had back in the 70s on the stereo there. And most of the time you'd take the middle and drop it down and the highs and lows would go up and you get what they called the disco smile. but that equalizer allows you to tweak things. And a lot of times, you know, you might have a setup where if you've got a speaker in a corner, it might have too much low end coming out of it. Or, you know, depending on how you have things in your room or what kind of speakers you have, you may find that using a different EQ setting in iTunes actually makes things sound better. And that's what it's for. But that's only for iTunes, as Pat points out. So how can you equalize all of your audio? Well, one program that I've used to do this many times, and I'm actually using it right now to record this podcast, is Audio Hijack Pro from Rogue Amoeba. And with that, you can hijack the system audio, or really any audio chain. It's a very, very flexible program. But you hijack the audio, and then you can apply effects to it. And one of the many effects you can apply is an equalizer. So you would hijack system audio and then apply some effects to it. And, you know, one might be an equalizer and you set things the way you want. Another cool thing, and I used to do this years ago with like, you know, third person or first person shooter games, rather, is I'd add a little reverb to the sound so that when you fire the gun or whatever, it, you know, it really kind of gives it some depth and space and that sort of thing. So there's all kinds of stuff you can do. But Audio Hijack Pro, for me, is the app that I would use. If there's some other app out there that's just built to EQ system sound, please tell us about it, because that would be kind of a cool thing to hear about. Moving on to John. John, does that sound right? And I didn't mean John. John.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Hey, John and Dave. My name is John from Minneapolis. I have another question for you that I might be able to answer. It has to do with wireless and the BGN standards and just wireless access points and routers in general. First of all, my boss here, where I came from, my boss at work made the claim that even if you have a G route or G card running on an N system, that the G card would not lower the speed of any other N systems on the card. So if you're running at 208 on an N, and you introduce a 54 G card to that the N card would still run at full speed. I didn't think that was right, so I wanted to ask you about that first. And then he claimed that if you have multiple N signals going to an N router, let's say you have four, that instead of getting the full theoretical 108, each one of those would get a fourth of that, so it acts like a hub. I didn't think that was right either, but it was hard to find anything on Google about that. So I'm doing some research, and I thought, you guys are smart. I thought maybe you'd know. So anyway, what can you tell me? All right, thanks. Bye.
Yeah, you bet. Okay, so we will quickly revisit this. If you go back and listen to Geek Gab 147, which we did on March 31st of this year, we actually talked through a lot of this stuff. But the net of it is, your N machine, if it says that it's transmitting at 208 and you add a G or a B machine to that same network, your N machine will still say, I'm connected at a maximum throughput of 208, but it does slow it down by adding the B or G, because it's got to change the symbol rate. Effectively, it's got to chop up the packets in a way to make things work for all the computers on the network, and that effectively slows down your maximum bandwidth. Again, we went through this in great detail in 147, so there's no real reason to beat through this particular horse here.
In general, and sometimes you have to do the secret handshake to get the setting here, you can set up the base to only talk at the most recent protocol.
Right.
So you can tell now we have the time capsule, I can say, okay, only talk N.
Right.
Unfortunately, my TiVo with its G adapter would not be happy with that.
Right.
So once you get into the compatibility mode, you open up the potential for things to slow down, not as slow as the lowest common denominator.
Right.
But it will take a hit because it's trying to make everybody happy.
Right.
And you just can't go at full bore to do that. So just want to, in a nutshell, I think that's our conclusion with that. And then I guess the second point there makes sense to me.
Yeah, I agree. It actually does act like a hub. There is a maximum throughput. So if you've got four machines on the network and they're all in and only in, and let's say you're using your maximum 208. So really you're getting about 110, 115 effective throughput for one. It will chop that into four based on what I've seen. And that's that. There's only so much bandwidth in the air and you got to chop it up. So
I'd say is that it, as you start adding, approaching a ridiculous number of connections. So four, I would say it's safe to say that it divides it up. As you start talking 5, 10, 20, you get to the point where the overhead of keeping track of everybody gets to be, kind of like when we go to Macworld or some other, show where there's a ridiculous amount of people with wireless and they're all trying to dogpile on one, access point. And it's not going to happen.
Yeah,
I've seen this. There's just a point where the thing gets overwhelmed, either running out of leases or just, it can only handle so many. I forget what Apple advertises, if it's 50 people or something like that.
Yeah, I think
for a lot of their devices, I think they've touched upon it. But yeah, there's a realistic maximum. But four, I don't think is reaching that, that level at all.
No.
So hopefully based on, these answers, you still got a job. Well, you said it was for the boss. I mean,
yeah, no, that's
tell
important.
The boss that,
got to keep them happy. That's right. Okay. So Aaron, we already talked about Aaron a long time ago, but Ralph writes, asking about a time capsule, and he can't seem to find an answer for this question. He has the 1 terabyte version and has a 500 gig USB hard drive plugged into it that he uses as a shared disk between his Mac Pro and his wife's MacBook Pro. How can he get the time capsule / time machine to back up the external drive? Now, we're talking about the external drive attached to the time capsule. Any thoughts on this, John?
Yes. So I actually, during my adventure over the weekend, I did happen to have, because I haven't tried. I've only tried to plug a printer into my time capsule, and that works wonderfully. It's an HP 990 CSE, kind of dated inkjet, but it just works great.
I have the same one over at the house.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So I have, it's an oldie but a goodie. But then I'm like, well, what do I have lying around here that I could plug into the time capsule? And I had the drive that I normally use to back up my work machine. And I'm like, well, let me plug that in and see what happens. Now it's a LaCie. It will not, it needs external power. Unfortunately, I tried, I plugged it in with the USB cable and it's just like, huh?
Oh yeah.
So it's a class of device that just doesn't, the USB drive can't provide enough oomph for whatever the heck they're doing in there, which is kind of weird. But anyways, I plug it in, apply the power, and all of a sudden the light on the time capsule goes yellow. I'm like, oh my gosh, what the heck's going on here? I start up the utility and it says the disk that you have attached is something along the lines of damaged. Please run a repair on it. I'm like, oh my God, what the heck happened here?
Yeah.
Well, finally, I realized once I checked it from the Mac, and this is a mini rant and something that still kind of confuses me to this day.
Yeah.
And maybe our beloved listeners can help here, but the reason the time capsule was cranky about this is that it was an NTFS drive.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, pretty much the thing that you do on Windows.
Yeah, I guess that would be the
one
default,
of the options.
The default, one of the options from Windows 2000 and later, essentially. It's just a way of formatting. On the Mac, we talk about HFS Plus. On the Windows side, it's typically NTFS or FAT32, though there's some devices which would be FAT16. But they're all different ways of setting up a disk, and we'll leave it at that. NTFS, though, at least when plugged directly into a Mac, my experience, John, is that NTFS in OS X is read only. You cannot write to the volume without jumping through a bunch of extra hoops.
Yeah, so two rants here. So one rant is what the time capsule said was totally wrong. And that the drive was not damaged. It was, well, unless you consider formatting a drive with NTFS is damaging it, but
well,
I don't. And then why the heck can't the OS, it sees it, it's just always read only. Why? Now there may be, as you pointed out, I don't know off the top of my head if there are third party utilities that will
there are
allow you to interact normally with it. There are. Okay.
Well, so, there are on the Mac. I don't know. I'm guessing that's not going to extend to the time capsule. So.
Okay. So the time capsule is one issue, but then why the Mac OS itself cannot write to an NTFS volume? I don't know. Maybe they're creating an opportunity for, you know, individual developers.
I don't know. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that it has something to do with the whole permissioning scheme on NTFS. It actually gets really, really complex. And that's sort of the beauty of NTFS is, as a server operating system, you can make it so that individual files have different permissions, just like Unix, actually. But it goes a little deeper than that. So that may be the reason they just said, you know what, just put up the wall. They can read from it. That's all they need. Mm-hmm. You know, we know what you need. We're Apple.
Yeah. Okay. So then I tried something else. I'm like, well, gosh, you know, that, so that doesn't work. And what else do I have here? I have a FireWire drive. Unfortunately, it's a USB port. And I'm like, you know, let me try this just for yucks. And I took my flash drive, which is formatted as a FAT32.
Yeah.
I plugged it in and I never thought of doing this before, but it showed up just fine as another disk.
Oh, awesome.
So what a cool way to share your flash drive. And, you know, it fit. There was enough clearance for this thing. So that was really neat, but I could never get to the point. I mean, and when you connect to the time capsule or the disks connected to it, they just show up as this thing called SharePoint. I was trying to figure out a way, and you know, I'll spend a little more time on it, but I was trying to figure a way to drag that onto the main drive of the machine in question to see if I could trick it into... No, it's just... So as far as I can tell at this point, I'm sure Apple could enable this. I mean, heck, it's connected to the device.
Yeah.
Now, on the other hand, it doesn't, the time capsule doesn't have the time machine software. So yeah, I'll have to step back. Because really, the drive, I don't think, knows anything at all about time machine. It's just a drive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. That's right.
So I'm going to say that the time capsule on its own is not going to have the ability to be smart. I think the OS, so maybe in a future update, they will take these, I guess they call them air disks or whatever, and make a connected device, or maybe some clever person will come up with a, well, no, it'd have to be a hack.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I guess the thing is, and then I did a bit more experimenting. I'm like, well, you know what? What if, though this isn't really solving the problem, but I'm like, what if you connect it to the machine in question? Because I was up until tonight, because I haven't tried it, under the impression that time capsule and time machine would only deal with the boot drive of your machine. And I think that's really what it's intended for, Dave.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I'm going to go ahead and play the next question we've got here, because we're getting into that subject realm, and there's some specific things that Joe asked. So I'm going to go ahead and roll the dice and play this question here.
Hey, John and Dave, Joe here from Raleigh, North Carolina, longtime listener, few time caller, had a question regarding time machine. And in particular, what happens in Time Machine if you boot off of another bootable drive that has Time Machine running? My backup strategy is whenever I run an update, I copy everything over with Carbon Copy Cloner to another drive, boot off of that drive, and then run all the updates on that drive. That's all worked fine for years. But Time Machine has sort of kind of thrown a twist into that. What I had done in the preferences of that, since I have duplicate versions essentially on two different volumes of the system and user folders and such, I had excluded the drive that I wasn't actually booting from in the preferences for Time Machine so that I won't, you know, booting up twice as much information as I needed to. Or backing up twice as much information as I needed to. Now that I've dubbed or cloned everything over and am booting off the alternative drive to run the latest series of updates, I find now in that clone that the drive I'm booted off of is in fact in the exclusion list, implying that I am doing Time Machine off the now older volume. And I'm not sure how to fix that. If you guys have any thoughts, I'd appreciate it. And here's where you cut me off.
Okay. Yeah, so this is interesting. So, yeah, Time Machine, it's important to understand how Time Machine backs things up. So if you're backing up to a time capsule, which I realize Joe is not, based on what I'm understanding here, but it really doesn't matter. You're backing up to a time capsule. What it does is it creates a disk image on that time capsule. If you're backing up to a FireWire hard drive, it does not create a separate disk image. At that point, everything else is the same. On that disk, either the external disk or the disk image, it creates a backups.backupdb folder. Inside that folder is the name of the computer that's being backed up. Inside that folder is all of the backups you have, but really they're all interlocked. So if you go into the latest, which is an alias to the most recent one, you'll see icons or folders for each drive that you have backed up, the name of each drive. So in Joe's situation, where he's got two drives that he's booting from, even if the new or the backup drive or whatever you want to call it starts backing up to Time Machine, unless it's named the same as the first drive, which I'm assuming it's not, then it's going to be fine. You may want to turn it off, but it's still, it's going to back up to a different place. So it's not going to blow away all the stuff that you've backed up. You can back up multiple drives to a Time Machine, to a Time Machine store. Now, to go back to our, let's answer Joe's question here. So, to me, it sounds like it's working totally fine. You could exclude the by name going into the Time Machine preferences. You could exclude the secondary drive that you're using. And then if you're cloning the first drive to the second drive, well, that setting will stick. And when you boot Time Machine or when you boot from the secondary drive, it won't back up because that setting sticks by name. It omits that drive. So going back to what John and I were saying before, by default, Time Machine only backs up the internal drive. Now, how does it do this? Well, by automatically excluding all external drives, but you can unexclude them by going into the Time Machine preferences. And I believe it's the privacy tab. Is that right, John?
Well, I think it's options.
Yeah. Options and then privacy,
click
right?
On options. And then it says do not back up.
Do not back up. Okay. So I'm thinking of Spotlight. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
That's and I have seen that a mini tangent. I have seen on occasion, I don't know if it's a bug where it is, but I've seen Spotlight attempt to index the Time Machine backup drive. Have you seen this?
Yes. Yes, I have.
First time I saw it, I'm like, what are you doing?
Yep.
Why are you indexing a backup of something?
Yep.
And I told it to cut it out. So I think that's a bug.
Yeah, it is. And the way I've stopped that to wrap up that tangent is simply by going into Spotlight preferences and clicking on privacy. You'll see the backup drive already listed there. But as soon as I go there, the index stops. So there you go. Yeah. But anyway, so if you have a backup, if you have an external drive, like on my MacBook Pro downstairs, John, I've got three different FireWire drives that are connected most of the time. One of them has two partitions. So to the Mac, it appears as though four devices are attached, or four drives are not attached, but there's four drives mounted. So you go into Time Machine and all of them are omitted. Well, one of them contains my iTunes music library, and I want that backed up. So I just go in and I remove that from the do not backup list. And sure enough, next time away it went. So, I think for Joe, you're fine. For Ralph, I wish I had an answer for you, buddy, but I don't think it's a limitation of the software in the time capsule. And unless you or someone out there figures out a way to hack that software, I think we're at an impasse on that one.
Yeah. And to wrap up, though, so I had tried today. So here's an interesting little piece of input, I think. Anyways.
Okay.
So when I tried on my portable to see, because I'd never tried this before, but for you, the listener, I'm willing to try just about anything at least once. I plugged in both my FAT32 USB drive and I have a FireWire drive that's formatted as a HFS Plus or, extended.
Yep.
And both of those appeared in as you pointed out, Dave, they appeared in the time capsule, do not touch list. Though the weird thing is that the flash drive, it was grayed out because and it never backed it up. So as far as I can tell, FAT32, Time Machine doesn't like FAT32. It really likes, macOS extended.
Interesting.
As far as the backup drive. The only thing I could think of, and it was kind of a hack, is that Yeah, if you have a drive and it's not too big plugged into the time capsule, you can drag the whole darn thing over to the hard drive on your machine that's going to the time capsule. But then you're replicating the data. Yeah, that's just, that's a hack. That's terrible.
Yeah.
So yeah. It, I mean, it would accomplish the task. It would back up the data. The problem is it just seems silly because it's so close. I mean, it's in the time capsule.
Yeah.
Why can't you suck the data out of it? So
it's too close. It needs to be arm's length in order to back it up.
So feature request for Apple, I think that would be an awesome feature to back up as an option to back up the, technically it's possible.
Yeah.
And they just have to manage, you know, should they do that?
Right. Well, you know, Apple's got that whole 80-20 thing, right? Don't spend 80% of your time on something that 20% of the users want. Spend, you know, all of your time on stuff that 80% of the users want.
Yeah, I mean, the only other thing I could think, but then the guy would have to leave the machine on, is that you could plug that drive instead of the time capsule, and I can certainly see the advantage. Like when I found with the flash drive, he could plug it into I mean, if he has a Mac that he leaves on all the time, that's the answer. But it sounds to me like, that's also kind of a hack.
Yeah,
to plug that drive, as we pointed out, into a Mac, because then, I mean, you could turn on file sharing, but again, it's only going to be available when that machine is on, whereas the time capsule is always available to everybody.
Right. Yeah, which is a beautiful thing. All right, one quick thing. You know, this is something I've been using forever, at least as long as I can remember in recent history. But Jonathan wrote in and pointed us to a cool little service called TinyURL, TinyURL. And many of you have probably used this service. It's a place where you go, John, and you have a big, long URL for something, and you paste it in, and what you get out of it is a very short URL, typically tinyurl.com/, you know, some 5-character code. And it's usually good for a month or so. So it's great if you need to pass it around or post it to Twitter, you know, that kind of thing. One service
for the newbies out there, a URL is the thing that you type into your web browser. Uniform Resource Locator. Just for those that don't know, and it usually begins with http://, but it could begin with other things. But just
Oh, you're right.
For people saying, "What's a URL, John?"
I appreciate
you and
that.
I know that because
this is what we do. So then I figured out a way of doing this a little bit better, I figured it out. I found, and it's a website called Snurl, S-N-U-R-L. And what Snurl lets you do is put a little thing right up there in your menu bar, like a little bookmark button. And whatever URL you're at, you hit the Snurl thing, and bam, it creates a snurl.com URL and automatically copies it to your clipboard if you're using recent versions of Safari. So very, very handy, and then returns you back to the web page. So you don't have to jump all around. You just hit the little thing, and then bam, it's copied in. So I just wanted to point that out. It's a little JavaScript-based utility, but you just drag it to your bookmarklet bar, and you're good to go. So, or bookmarks bar, I guess, is what Apple calls it. So snurl.com or tinyurl.com. And one last thing, because I've mentioned it before and people have done great things with it, is if any of you are interested in the VoIP service Vonage, let me know, because I can refer you now, and you get a couple of months free. And it actually helps support the show, too, which is never a bad thing.
Now, you know, TinyURL, to go back for just a little bit, that the technology itself is neither good nor evil, just the people that use it.
Correct.
But, you know, if you may have to be careful, because a URL typically reveals the nature of the contents, whereas a tiny URL thing does not. So, for example, you could get Rick Rolled.
Yes, that's right.
And we will link to a Rick Roll for the one or two people out there that don't know what that is, because I think that one's
so like March.
Tired.
Yeah, that's right.
That one's that's so last month. Yeah, or 2 months ago.
Yeah.
But anyways, it could be used to play pranks on your friends, because they look at it and it's, you know, like eight random characters or whatever they use, and you could get a nasty surprise.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But it could also be good because, I mean, who wants to type in, you know, hundreds of characters?
Yeah, and email sometimes, you know, mail sometimes breaks up URLs even though it's not supposed to. So TinyURL can, you know, crunch that down into a nice little format. So,
yep.
All right.
Wow.
We, you know, I thought about it during one of the sections here, one of our segments, but we didn't say it. So 206-666-GEEK, which is 206-666-4335 is the number to call if you want to have your question considered for part of the show. We're happy.
How about email?
What is the email, John?
I think it's feedback@macgeekab.com.
That's the one. You got it.
All right. Yeah.
And then you can Skype to MacGeekGab. So if you've got Skype set up and you want to do it that way, it's great. That filters right into our voicemail box. We won't miss those either. So come, please check, you know, send all your stuff in. We love to have it. I know I was mentioning at the beginning of the show that we're overrun with email. That's a good thing. It's great. So iPhoneAlley.com is Michael Johnston's site, and Michael is the one that converts this show into AAC for your interactive pleasure. The bandwidth is provided by CashFly, and that's what gets you the show real, real fast, and we love them for it. The podcast marketplace includes the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebones Software, Text Expander from Smile on My Mac, and of course, our favorite travel site, Harman-eTravel.com. Is there anything else, John? Comments?
You know, those iTunes, we're up to 166 right now.
Yeah, can we be at 200 by the end of May? Please, guys, and gals, and all of our beloved listeners here.
Well, you know, especially there's this other one, the MacCast.
Oh, have we love Adam. Yeah, that's great.
Oh, we do? Because he's got 168.
He'll love it when he hears
this. So come on, man. Just give us two listeners. We got to beat Adam.
Wow, I didn't realize this was a competition. All right, well
now it is.
I guess it is.
He's part of the
Backbeat Media Network. Yeah,
Backbeat Media family. So hi, Adam, and we're gonna. Yeah, we should.
should we set up a contest?
A polite comment.
There you go.
Don't put garbage in there. Come on.
No. Put the real stuff in there. Put what you feel and.
But we found them very useful. Constructive. Criticism is always welcome.
Always.
As well as just, you know, gushing, praise. But, hey.
You know, with that, I think it's time.
Yeah.
We'll let the band play us out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hey, did you get your stimulus check?
No, I didn't. Should I?
I didn't either. I don't know.
I don't know where it is.
You filed your taxes, right?
Taxes. You know, along those lines, all I'm going to say is don't get caught.
Maynard.